This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, now offering Peaberry Especial, a blend of rare pea berries from Colombia, New Guinea, and Tanzania. For a limited time at Pete's retail stores or on the web at Pete's.com.
For KBLO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KABU's FIFA Amin Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KABU News.
KABU's Eduardo de Landeros Fiere has more.
I'm Ana Lisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KABU News.
I'm Michael Newman, KABU News.
I'm Courtney Diller, KABU News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, Edith Morante, author of Burmese Looking Glass, will join us live in the studio to talk about human rights issues in Burma.
Changes in the organization of high school sports has parents and students distressed. KABU's Spencer Raymond brings us that report.
Cirque du Corruption? Portland officials are investigating a city building inspector who accepted free tickets to a Cirque du Soleil show for a beneficial inspection report.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,317 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 32,000 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Tuesday, March 20. I'm Doug Weedy.
And I'm Isaac Kaplan-Wolner.
Utility speculator Warren Buffett's holding company, MidAmerican Energy Holding Company, officially completed its $9.2 billion buyout of PacifiCorp today. The Des Moines, Iowa-based corporation says it will divide PacifiCorp into three separate business units. Officials said the move will, quote, improve accountability to customers. Pacific Power, to be headed by PacifiCorp veteran Stan Waters, will deliver electricity to customers in Oregon, Washington, and California. The company's Rocky Mountain Power Unit, which also includes Utah Power, will deliver electricity to customers in Utah, Wyoming, and Idaho. Buffett says has made a fortune through buying distressed utilities cheaply and selling them at a profit. On announcing Buffett's purchase of PacifiCorp, Portland Utility Commissioner Director Lee Beyer told the KABU Evening News that Buffett personally reassured him he had no plans to sell off Portland's utility.
A group of Oregon school districts officially filed suit today against the state of Oregon. KABU's Kristen Flagg has more.
Six public school districts and three families filed suit against the state of Oregon today over inadequate school funding. The plaintiffs charged that the state has betrayed its constitutional duty to finance a quality K-12 public education for all students by letting class sizes rise, key subject areas remain understaffed, and decreasing per-pupil spending overall. Art Johnson, the plaintiff's lead attorney, notes the changes he's seen take place since budget cuts began with 1990's Measure 5.
I had the blessing of going to public schools in Eugene, Oregon that prepared me to go on further, and there's no comparison between the opportunity that was given to me and the opportunity that's being given to the same children today. There's a moral question, there's an ethical question, but in this lawsuit there's a constitutional question, and the legislature has failed and should be held accountable.
In 2000, Oregon citizens voted in favor of Measure 1, which requires the state to provide a sufficient sum of money to schools in each biennium's budget to meet the state's own goals for education. The legislature formed the Oregon Quality Education Commission to determine the right amount. In 2004, this body reported that the state should allocate at least $7.1 billion to schools in the 2005-2007 budget. However, the legislature only approved $5.3 billion. The plaintiffs in this suit include Eugene, Crow Applegate, Coos Bay, Corvallis, and Three Rivers School Districts. Pendleton School District was the first to sign on. Board member and former Pendleton High School government teacher Dave Betke says he hopes the lawsuit will also bring public awareness to the plights of districts across the state.
I think we have cut prudently. Probably have done as good a job as any district in the state in managing the scarce resources. And I think we just, as a board, when presented with this offer, thought it was a good way to send a message to the state legislature that something needs to be done for a long-term cure for financing public schools. And if nothing else, it will draw public attention.
Similar lawsuits have been filed in 38 states. 21 of those lawsuits have been successful. Tomorrow on KBOO News, we'll speak with educators, administrators, and parents in Pendleton, Oregon, about what led them to join this lawsuit. For KBOO Radio News, I'm Kirsten Flagg.
Portland officials said Monday that they would investigate a city building inspector who accepted two free tickets to a Cirque du Soleil show. Mark Vasquez inspected the circus March 10th in Southwest Portland. As he was leaving, circus officials offered him tickets worth about $70 each to the opening show. Such a gift is perfectly legal. However, Commissioner Randy Leonard, who manages the inspectors, said the incident would be investigated because it gives the appearance of corruption. Current law allows government regulators, such as building inspectors, to accept as much as $100 in gifts a year from someone they regulate. Leonard decided to look into the case after he received an anonymous email yesterday alleging that Vasquez took tickets worth $500 in exchange for a beneficial inspection report. Vasquez says he received two tickets and gave them to a co-worker who used them. Vasquez later bought four tickets for his own family.
Three Oregon school districts are challenging a proposal by the Oregon School and Activities Association that changes the organization of high school sports. Schools in Salem, Eugene, and Medford are angry that a new plan will make it difficult to play school sports. And last week, the Oregon Board of Education put a halt to the proposal. The Oregonian's editorial board has even joined the argument. KBOO's Spencer Raymond reports on the mess Oregon high school sports are currently in.
High school sports in the state of Oregon will drastically change next year. That is, if the OSAA gets their way. A special committee formed by the Oregon School Activities Association, or the OSAA, recommended changes to how Oregon high schools are grouped for sports competition. In the current system, Oregon high schools are broken into four classes based on student body population. 4A is the largest, 1A the smallest. The new plan, approved by the OSAA last fall, creates six classes of competition and would take effect this August. Sounds simple, right? Wrong. For high schools in Salem, Eugene, and Medford, the new plan will cause problems. Eugene Sheldon and South Eugene High Schools are now part of a league that includes Medford schools. So, for regular league games, two Eugene high schools will have to travel the equivalent of Portland to Seattle to compete.
The bottom line is we're going to take a 2.5 to 3 hour trip to Medford 22 times next year through all of our sports.
That's Dave Hancock, the athletic director at South Eugene High School.
I mean, how can you justify that? How can you justify the cost of that?
To challenge the OSAA's plan, school districts from Eugene, Salem-Keizer, and Medford appealed. The three districts argue that the OSAA did not follow their own guidelines when creating the new system. The OSAA committee had several criteria when creating the new system. It included competitive balance, travel expenses, loss of student class time, and maintaining school's athletic tradition and history. The school districts say the OSAA did not follow these, but instead created unnecessary harm to student athletes and coaches by increasing travel expenses and causing student athletes to miss class time. With smaller leagues, schools can no longer play each other just twice. In some instances, schools will have to travel to the same opponent twice in one season, in addition to hosting the same team once at home.
Suddenly we're playing triple round robins just to get 15 games in, so let's add some more miles.
But as South Eugene and Sheldon leave their fellow Eugene schools in the Midwestern League, that league will shrink too.
If this goes through, the teams that stay here and stay in the 5A, they're going to play triple round robins also. So So suddenly your whole schedule is filled up with, well, you're going to play one team three times.
So more schools will have to play triple round robins. Last month, hearing officer Bill Young ruled that the OSAA failed to obtain approval from the Oregon Board of Education in creating the criteria for the new system on March 13th. State Superintendent for Public Instruction Susan Castello agreed, ruling that the OSAA violated state law by implementing the changes. The OSAA now has 30 days to reappear before the Oregon Board of Education to seek approval for their plan. If not, high school sports next year could be thrown into limbo. Steve Walker, the Sports Information Director at the OSAA, said the OSAA's executive board has already resubmitted the plan to the Board of Education.
The request would be for the Board of Education to address the resubmitted plan just as soon as possible because, as everybody knows, you know, time is of the essence now with, we're into the second part of the school year and, this plan would be in place for fall and there's already schedules made. So, no matter what happens, there needs to be confirmation of what we will move forward with.
On its website, the OSAA says it is, quote, confident that the State Board of Education will support the outcome from the committee. Another argument against the new classification is that it will create six different championships for each of the six classes. With six playoffs, it creates more opportunity for the OSAA to make money off ticket sales.
There's no question football is a moneymaker for the OSAA, as is basketball. But you got to remember that really the OSAA operates like a college does regarding its programs, where certain programs make the majority of the money for the association and help fund the other programs that don't.
But as the new classification dictates, there are only seven schools outside the Portland-Salem area in the largest and arguably most competitive class, 6A. All this while the OSAA, on its website, says it strives to, quote, work to promote inter-school activities that provide equitable participation opportunities. I'm Spencer Raymond, KBOO News.
The current time is 5:13, and now daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
George W. called it a great example, declaring that our country should take some lessons from it. The it that has so enamored George is the privatized Social Security system that was imposed on the people of Chile 25 years ago by the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. His system of having workers pay into personal pension accounts managed by private investment banks is called the Chilean model, and it has long been hailed by laissez-faire think tanks and by the Bushites as a model for privatizing our own nation's Social Security program. Before we swallow this pill of privatization, however, we might want to ask the people of Chile how they have fared under its marketplace magic. Not well. Chilean workers who participate have 10% of their paychecks deducted and put into the hands of the private pension bankers. Yet half of the Chilean people cannot afford this deduction, so they end up with no old age pension whatsoever. Of those who do participate, the rules are so rigged that 40% cannot accumulate enough money in the system to have a livable retirement. As a top official of the Economic Commission for Latin America bluntly puts it, the bottom line is that this system does not work. Well, it might not work for the people, but it's working very nicely for the bankers. The six funds now running the privatized system are enjoying an average annual profit of 50%. The reason for such astonishing profits is, of course, the same reason that U.S. banks are riding high: exorbitant fees. The World Bank finds that Chilean pension managers are ripping off between a fourth and a third of the workers' payments in the form of commissions and other fees. Compare that to our own Social Security system, which takes only 1% for administrative costs and covers everyone. This is Jim Hightower saying, Bush is right. We can take some lessons from the Chilean model. Lesson number one is forget it. Support for this program comes from the Progressive Magazine, featuring columnists Miley Ivins, Howard Zinn, and Barbara Ehrenreich, with features and information available at progressive.org.
Stay-
Stay tuned for free speech radio news and independent native news following our newscast. Then, at 6 p.m., hear This Way Out. At 7, Amanda Genis brings us Amanda's Jam Corner. It's a bit gray here in Portland, with a chance of showers tonight, then rain likely after midnight. Lows 40 to 45. Tomorrow, rain likely, warming up to around 55 degrees. Southeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. In Hood River, scattered showers tonight, lows around 40. Rain likely tomorrow, highs 50 to 55. East wind 5 to 15 miles per hour, 10 to 20 miles per hour west of Cascade Locks. And for our listeners in Salem, a chance of showers this evening. Then rain likely after midnight, lows around 40. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a slight chance of rain, lows 40 to 45 and light wind. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
An autopsy will be done today on a 46-year-old Portland man who was tasered by police yesterday. Police spokesman Paul Dolby said the stun gun was held directly against the man's body, jolting him with 50,000 volts of electricity. Police said it happened on Sandy Boulevard near 30th Street yesterday afternoon. The man was running and yelling in traffic and became combative when police tried to take him into custody. Witnesses said the man was yelling and foaming at the mouth. The police officer was trying to get the man out of traffic, and when he resisted, the officer shocked him twice. After being shot by the taser, the man was conscious and alert but died on the way to the hospital.
With prescription drug prices continuing to climb, Oregon's prescription drug purchasing program is getting rave reviews on its first birthday for bringing costs back down. KBOO's Angela Hancock Revis reports.
The state says Oregonians have saved over $420,000 on prescription drugs this year by using the purchasing pool. Jerry Cohen with AARP Oregon says an average savings of $25 for each prescription makes a big difference, especially for people who rely on expensive medications.
We're excited because it's the first step toward making prescription drugs more affordable and accessible for all Oregonians.
Cohen says the pool should be accessible to more Oregonians in the future. The program currently allows school districts and state and local governments to negotiate with drug manufacturers and pharmacies for discounted prescription rates. The pool is also open to low-income residents with no insurance.
The marketplace, when allowed to pool people together, can work. Doesn't matter which side of the aisle or ideology you use then, it's savings.
Low-income seniors who have signed up for Medicare Part D prescription plans are still eligible for the Oregon program. Cohen says the plan is a compromise between manufacturers, pharmacists, and the state. Content was provided by the Oregon News Service. I'm Angela Hancock Revis, KBOO News.
State Representative Linda Flores, Republican of Clackamas, will be among the featured speakers at an anti-immigration rally on the steps of the Capitol at noon on Friday. The rally is organized by conservative groups, Oregonians for Immigration Reform. It features an appearance by KPAM radio talk show host Victoria Taft. She will speak on her project called Operation ID. Taft collected letters from thousands of Oregonians in the past 2 months that call on the governor, the secretary of state, and other state leaders to, quote, check if persons applying for state benefits, driver's licenses, and voting privileges are American citizens and legal residents of Oregon. Boxes full of those letters will be presented to Governor Ted Kulikowski on Friday. Flores was the chief sponsor of failed legislation in the 2005 legislative session that would have required proof of citizenship before registering to vote in Oregon.
The country of Burma is in many ways a forgotten war zone. A military dictatorship has escalated an ethnic genocide campaign against the indigenous Burmese people. China has stepped up clear-cut logging and strip mining there. Yet many Americans probably could not locate Burma on a map. Here in Studio 2 with us is local author Edith Maranti. She speaks tonight at Annie Bloom's Books about her newest memoir of travel in Burma, Down the Rat Hole, Adventures Underground on Burma's Frontiers. Thanks for joining us, Edith.
Thank you.
Can you tell us, this book you'll be reading from tonight is your second memoir on Burma. What has changed since you published your first book? Give us a brief outline of some of the issues now facing the country.
Well, since the first book, which took place when I was really learning about Burma in the 1980s, there's been a big uprising in Burma. In 1988, people all throughout the country came out on the streets nonviolently demanding freedom and democracy after years and years of military rule. Unfortunately, that was suppressed in the most brutal possible manner, with thousands and thousands of people killed. And a junta, a committee of generals, continues to rule Burma. Since then, they have sought funding to build their army up even bigger than it was before. Now it's almost a third the size of the U.S. Army in a country with about 43 million people. And to do that, to fund it, they've sought every possible kind of hard currency from overseas, going into business with multinational oil companies like Unocal, which is now owned by Chevron Texaco, and making those logging deals with China and getting richer and richer from their ties to the multinationals.
So how can a nation spiral into such corruption and violence without garnering any media coverage? Why aren't we hearing more about this on the news?
Well, the generals really do try to keep it all clamped down. They suppress information within the country, and they also keep journalists from going in there for the most part. When that uprising happened in 88, it was like Tiananmen Square, only on a larger scale, but without the TV cameras. And nowadays there is an international Free Burma movement, which is mostly linked up through the internet, which is suppressed inside Burma, but everywhere else you can find Burma information that way. So our only hope is that when something like that happens again in Burma, which it will eventually, that this time the world doesn't have its back totally turned to the country, especially since countries like the United States with our oil companies are involved there, whether people know about it or not.
What motivated you to return to Burma and write this second book?
Well, my first book took place on the Thailand-Burma border, and in 1988 I got kicked out of Thailand and told never to come back, basically. And so after being banned in Bangkok, I went to Burma's other borders, its border with China, India, Bangladesh, and Laos, and found out amazing things that were going on in even those more remote places. For instance, the logging in China, where China had stopped the timber companies from clear-cutting in their own country, but then they went straight across the border to Burma and have been destroying the last old-growth forests there, much of which is very, very much like what we have here in the Pacific Northwest and even more endangered than it is here.
Reviews have called this book a travelogue. Would you say that you had political motivations for writing this book?
Yeah, it's a combination of travel and memoir and adventure and very much political. I know a lot of travel books are, you know, just about having a good time in Tuscany or somewhere, but this one is really about the amazing people that I met and what I learned from them in the war zones of Burma.
And we know it's Women's History Month and that Annie Blooms is observing Southeast Asia Night tonight. Can you briefly tell us what's going on at the bookstore tonight?
Yeah, I'll be reading with my friend Willa Schneeberg, who worked with the UN in Cambodia, so it's kind of Burma and Cambodia night. And she's an Oregon Book Award-winning poet. She'll be reading from her book, In the Margins of the World, and I'll be reading my own stories about Burma. And both of us, in our way, have been witnesses to history as it's unfolded in Southeast Asia, in more hopeful ways in Cambodia. After all, they survived there, and in an ongoing genocidal regime in Burma is what I've observed there.
All right. Thank you very much, Edith.
Thank you.
That was Edith Moranti. She speaks tonight about her experiences in Burma at 7:30 p.m. at Annie Bloom's Books, 7834 Southwest Capitol Highway in Multnomah Village, Portland. For more information, call them at 503-246-0053.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 21st, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on Translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on Translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producers for tonight's newscast are Angela Hancock-Revis and Jim Thompson. Tonight's audio editor is Lisa Loving. Special thanks to reporters Kirsten Flagg and Spencer Raymond. Our engineer is Judy Feistel. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Doug Guidi.
And I'm Isaac Kaplan-Wolner. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News, followed by Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30 a.m., Barbara Bernstein hosts Locus Focus Talk Radio. Her guest is Ted Nace, author of Gangs in America, The Rise of Corporate Power and the Disabling of Democracy. At 9, it's Movie Talk with Ed, DK, and Dawn on the latest films. At 9:30, on Speaking of Animals, host Lori Sonnenfeld speaks with Ken Foster, author of The Dogs Who Found Me, What I've Learned from Pets Who Are Left Behind, about the redemptive power of rescuing and caring for dogs. At 10, on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller speaks with Maud Barlow, National Chairperson of the Council of Canadians, Canada's largest public advocacy organization. A best-selling author, her latest book is Too Close for Comfort, Canada's Future Within Fortress North America. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Thanks for joining us.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, March 21st, 2006. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Brian Edwards Tiegert, sitting in for Auto Bogato. President George W. Bush gives a rare unscripted press conference today amidst growing opposition to his policy in Iraq. A business-dominated commission delivers its blueprint for redeveloping New Orleans. Critics charge it could change the face of the city permanently. And we continue our coverage of the Fourth World Water Forum in Mexico City with a look at Coca-Cola's role in staging the forum. But first, these headlines.
From WBAI in New York, I'm Mitch Cheserich with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A Maryland court-martial found Sergeant Michael Smith guilty on 6 of 13 charges for using dogs to terrify detainees at Abu Ghraib from year 2003 to 2004. The government contended that Smith used his black Belgian shepherd to intimidate 5 prisoners for fun and competed with another canine handler trying to make detainees soil themselves.
So what we need to see is when a new Army field manual comes out on interrogation, and one is imminent, that it is perfectly clear on what is allowed and what is prohibited.
While Smith could face up to 8 years in prison, human rights activists like Avi Kover, a lawyer with Human Rights First, says that it's important that individual perpetrators are not the scapegoats for what they call a system that allows for such abuses.
One of the important lessons learned, perhaps in this trial and in other instances of abuse, is the danger of setting different standards for different individuals. In the name of fighting terror, the United States authorized different interrogation techniques that would be permitted on what they've termed unlawful enemy combatants. The danger with this terminology, the danger with allowing previously unauthorized techniques that were deemed abusive, is that it immediately begins a slippery slope where all individuals are perceived as terrorists, and you know, the dogs of war are let loose, so to speak, and this is the terrible danger that and what came to fruition here.
And that was Avi Kover with Human Rights First. The U.S. military is investigating allegations that its Marines killed 15 Iraqi civilians last November in Adithum, including 7 women and 3 children. The military's initial claim that the civilians died in a roadside blast was disproved by an earlier investigation. It will now be investigated whether the civilians died in a crossfire or were targeted deliberately in a potential war crime. In Nepal, Maoist rebels have ended a blockade, but violence continues. PC Dubey has more from Kathmandu.
Yesterday, Nepalese Maoists withdrew their 6-day nationwide blockade they had slapped March 14.
They did so in response to the mainstream political party's appeal to end the blockade, as it had spawned huge troubles for ordinary masses. But meanwhile, Maoists have stepped up assaults against security forces. During past 24 hours alone, they have killed some 29 soldiers and policemen in various parts of the country. Today, early morning, Maoists attacked and killed 10 policemen in the eastern Nepalese district of Japa. Some 30 persons, mainly civilians, are also reported to be injured. Yesterday morning, they had ambushed a military convoy, killing 13 soldiers and 2 civilians in Kavre district, barely 40 kilometers east of Kathmandu. However, in a clash with soldiers in Dhading district west of Kathmandu, this morning some 20 Maoists were killed. Altogether, over 50 persons, including 23 Maoists and 29 security personnel, have died during past 24 hours. Such heightened violence has unleashed terror among people. From Kathmandu, I am PC Dubey for Free Speech Radio News.
As the UN Convention on Biodiversity gets underway in Brazil, a new report by the Global Biodiversity Outlook says all key indicators on the future of diversity of life are heading in the wrong direction. The report says the abundance and variety of species continues to fall across the globe as rates of species extinction surge to their highest levels since the demise of the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. The U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear a case to give residents of Puerto Rico the right to vote in U.S. presidential elections. It is the latest development in a long-running debate on the Puerto Ricans' constitutional rights. Today, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is in the Bahamas for a meeting with CARICOM foreign ministers. Caribbean ministers are expected to question her about the U.S.'s efforts in Congress to widen the criminal net against undocumented immigrants and the implications such policies will have on immigrants and their countries of origin. Subhash Katil with Families for Freedom spoke on WBAI's wake-up call this morning.
There's been a breakdown in the ability to provide social services to a lot of folks that are getting deported from America. So a lot of deportees, when they're sent back, because they had their families and their incomes over here, and because even things like Social Security, which they've paid into, they can't collect once they're deported, many of them are homeless, many of them are unemployed, many of them can't find the barest means to live, and so they need a lot of help from a bunch of governments that either are not well-resourced or don't have the political will to deal with the problem as a social problem.
And that was Subhash Katil with Families for Freedom. New York City public libraries are allegedly refusing to distribute a youth publication put out by Indie Media. Kat Aaron has a story.
Indie Kids is a quarterly newspaper for children in grades 4 through 8, taking on topics from the war in Iraq to mining in West Virginia. The paper is distributed at schools and community centers throughout New York City, but not at local libraries. The New York and Queens public libraries had agreed to carry the paper, but as Amanda Vender of Indie Kids explains, they have since reneged on the deal.
Two area libraries agreed to distribute our paper, Indie Kids, but then they changed their minds, saying that Indie Kids isn't balanced, so that now they refuse to distribute the paper. We feel that the library should carry all kinds of publications from all different points of view, and if you look at the publications that the library does carry, they're not balanced, they're quite biased, and we think that the library should carry Indie Kids and publications with all diverse points of view.
The New York Public Library did not return a call for comment by deadline. The paper, a project of the New York Independent Media Center, is available online at nyc.indiemedia.org. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kat Aaron in New York City.
And I'm Mitch Jezerich with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News.
Today, President George W. Bush gave the press a rare opportunity, the chance to ask him questions. This last-minute unscripted news conference comes one day after the third anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, and amid increasingly negative public opinion polls for the president and his policy there. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports that the president used the opportunity to provide reporters false information.
For the second time this year, the president has held an open question-and-answer session with the press where he defended the war and the U.S.'s strategy. For the first time in several years, the president called on veteran White House reporter and critic of the Bush administration, Helen Thomas. She asked him about his personal reasons for going to war, since all evidence he gave publicly proved inaccurate.
But we realized on September 11, 2001, that killers could destroy innocent life. And I'm never going to forget it. And I'm never going to forget the vow I made to the American people that we will do everything in our power to protect our people. Part of that meant to make sure that we didn't allow people to provide safe haven to an enemy, and that's why I went into Iraq. Hold on for a second. Excuse me for a second, please. Excuse me for a second. They did. The Taliban provided safe haven for al-Qaeda. That's where al-Qaeda trained and... Helen, excuse me. Afghanistan provided safe haven for al-Qaeda. That's where they trained. That's where they plotted. That's where they planned the attacks that killed thousands of innocent Americans. I also saw a threat in Iraq. I was hoping to solve this problem diplomatically. That's why I went to the Security Council. That's why it was important to pass 1441, which was unanimously passed. And the world said, disarm, disclose, or face serious consequences. And therefore, we worked with the world. We worked to make sure that Saddam Hussein heard the message of the world. And when he chose to deny inspectors, when he chose not to disclose, then I had the difficult decision to make to remove him, and we did, and the world is safer for it.
It's hard to imagine what Bush could conceivably mean, since what we now know is that Saddam Hussein had absolutely, literally nothing to disclose.
Rahul Mahajan is a political commentator and author of Empire Notes.
Saddam Hussein totally destroyed his weapons of mass destruction programs, tried to remove every trace of their existence. In fact, some of the activity that was intercepted by U.S. intelligence services that Colin Powell said was evidence that Iraq was trying to hide its weapons of mass destruction was actually evidence of their removing the last traces of any weapons of mass destruction.
In addition to the news conference, Bush gave several speeches last week and one yesterday on the war's anniversary, where he fielded questions from the audience in Cleveland. Critics call the president's series of speeches a media blitz to gain public favor. Author Norman Solomon.
This is the same line about trying to justify an occupation of Iraq that, by almost anybody's account, is not going well. And I say almost anybody because Bush and his coterie of top advisors seem to be, at least in public, almost the only ones who make such rosy claims.
The president also answered a question about complete withdrawal of troops.
That, of course, is an objective, and that'll be decided by future presidents and future governments of Iraq.
So it won't happen on your watch.
You mean a complete withdrawal? That's a timetable. I can only tell you that I will make decisions on force levels based upon what the commanders on the ground say.
President Bush again denounced the claim that Iraq is in the midst of civil war and said he disagrees with former Prime Minister Iyad Alawi on that point. Vice President Dick Cheney gave a speech today on the progress that has been made in Iraq. And the president is expected to speak on the subject again tomorrow. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Northeastern Australians are still recovering from the devastation of this weekend's Category 5 cyclone. Australian conservationists say that global warming is increasing the severity of cyclones, and the Australian government must not ignore environmentally friendly policies aimed at limiting climate change. Meanwhile, in the United States, a new report ranks 100 of the world's largest businesses on their handling of global climate change. Selena Masuda reports from Washington, D.C.
Ceres, a Boston-based coalition of investors, environmental organizations, and other public interest groups, used a scoring system based on companies' sustained commitment to controlling greenhouse gas emissions, disclosing data and strategies, as well as regulatory actions. Investor pressure and a global demand for clean energy products are compelling U.S. businesses to act, but many businesses continue to fail to address their contribution to global warming, says Mindy Lubber of Ceres.
Many American companies still lag far behind their international peers on this issue. The four top scoring companies in the oil and gas sector were all based in Europe. No less worrisome, dozens of U.S. businesses in the electric power, oil and gas, coal, air transportation, and food product sectors are still largely dismissing this issue with business-as-usual strategies that may be putting their companies and their shareholders at risk.
A uniform national regulatory policy to guide companies is needed, says William Riley, a board member of DuPont, a science manufacturing company.
It would be so much more helpful if we move from a purely voluntary approach to a mandatory regulatory approach for cap and trade in climate, which is the the basis for our Clean Air Act of 1990, which is hugely successful, much more so economically than we'd expected, and I think points the way to how we should proceed on climate.
In the series report, DuPont and Alcoa ranked number 1 and 2 in meeting the challenges of greenhouse gas limits. Reporting from Washington, D.C., this is Selena Masuta.
Joining millions around the globe, over 10,000 people took to the streets in Portland, Oregon, Sunday to demonstrate their opposition to the war in Iraq. On Monday, the third anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, several people staged a sit-in at Senator Ron Wyden's office inside Portland's federal building. FSRN's Julie Sabatier reports from Portland.
Portland was host to one of the largest anti-war demonstrations in the U.S. Sunday, marking the third anniversary of Bush's shock and awe campaign in Iraq. Among the speakers at the rally, attended by over 10,000 people, was Iraqi journalist and human rights activist Iman Ahmed Kamas.
I thank the American people for saying no to war, but it is not enough. They have to say no to aggression, no to occupation. It is not enough to say, bring the troops home.
Kamas is part of the Iraqi Women's Delegation, a group of women who are currently traveling around the U.S. to share their firsthand experiences of life in Iraq. She also attended the gathering outside Oregon Senator Ron Wyden's office Monday. Local clergy, veterans, and community leaders gathered to deliver a petition calling on the senator to take a lead role in bringing an end to the war. Kelly Campbell of the American Friends Service Committee was among those in attendance.
Every day that Congress does not take up the issue of ending the war in Iraq, more people are dying. And having lost a family member on September 11th, I know what it's like. And it is incumbent on our elected officials who have the power to end this war to start representing the people who elected them. And it's incumbent on Senator Wyden to take that action here today. Thank you.
When Senator Wyden declined to meet with the group, 19 people went into his office to engage in nonviolent resistance. Press and legal observers were excluded from the building.
Out.
Will you talk to me outside?
Read the sign over there.
All 19 of the nonviolent demonstrators sat in the senator's office until about 6 p.m. when they were arrested for failure to obey a lawful order of a police officer. A few dozen people continued to protest outside the building throughout the day. For FSRN, this is Julie Sabatier in Portland, Oregon.
Last night, the Bring Back New Orleans Commission ended its term with the presentation of a formal plan for rebuilding the city. Critics say the planning process was dominated by developers and powerful business interests. New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin accepted most of the commission's findings, but did reject some of the more controversial proposals for neighborhood restructuring. Christian Roseland has more from New Orleans.
Of all the proposals of the Bring New Orleans Back Commission, perhaps the most controversial was a plan released in January for a freeze on building permits in certain neighborhoods such as the city's Lower Ninth Ward. New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin again rejected this proposal at the conclusion of the commission last night. But while Nagin has avoided telling residents they can't rebuild, he has been cautious about committing support to these neighborhoods. Last Sunday, Nagin said that these areas, including the Lower Ninth, New Orleans East, and Gentilly, would be rebuilding at their own risk. More than 6 months after last fall's levee breach, the Lower Ninth Ward still does not have potable water, and as a result, FEMA has refused to install temporary trailers for residents. Mayor Nagin, who last fall put out a call for displaced residents to return, has in recent weeks tried to distance himself from a literal interpretation of that statement.
You know, when I was asking people to come back, I was trying to make sure that we were clear and that if you're coming back, there are certain sections of the city that are totally ready and you can move in there, and other areas that still need a lot of work. And, you know, more people came back than we originally thought would come back. More people came back quicker than we originally thought.
Last night, Nagin approved most of the other findings of the Bring New Orleans Back Commission, or BNOB, which gave advice on everything from building permits and school restructuring to bringing back the cultural economy of the city. However, many of his plans and the entire composition of the BNOB came under fire from some residents. Baba Tunji Ahmed, director of the organization New Orleans Contractors and Craftsmen, expressed a common concern that local development mogul Joe Cannizzaro had excessive power in the commission.
Joe Cannizzaro is here for the smaller footprint.
That means less African Americans.
Ahmed, who spoke in the public comment portion of the meeting, says that the Bring New Orleans Back Commission is not living up to its stated purpose.
Not just the mayor, but the whole committee, the Louisiana Recovery Commission, FEMA, all these different entities, all these different alphabets, they have totally disregarded the descendants of the workers who built this city, who gave it its character and gave it everything that people love.
Other plans presented by the BNOB included the medium-term closing of the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet, or Mr. Go. Mr. Go is an industrial waterway that carried the storm surge that leveled parts of the city's lower Ninth Ward, and that residents in many parts of the city want permanently shut. Among them is Pam DeShiel, head of the Holy Cross Neighborhood Association in the lower Ninth Ward. DeShiel, who held a seat on the BNOB, says that she is concerned the commission did not include enough African Americans and that many of the urban planning decisions were made without consulting all members. However, DeShiel was not entirely dissatisfied with the recommendations, including making wetland restoration a priority for the city.
I thought that they made a start on environmental issues. It was not nearly strong enough, but it was pretty vague. But at least they acknowledged that. So that was a beginning.
The city will now proceed with developing a more local planning process, which Mayor Nagin describes as neighborhoods choosing their own futures. However, Nagin summed up the experience of rebuilding for many in New Orleans when he said that the devil will be in the details. For FSRN, this is Christian Roseland in New Orleans.
The Fourth World Water Forum continues this week in Mexico City. President Vicente Fox, the former head of Coca-Cola in Mexico, inaugurated the forum last week. The forum lists Mexico's Coca-Cola company as one of the leading sponsors of the event. Non-governmental organizations working on water issues are questioning the influence that that beverage company has at the gathering. Shannon Young and Vladimir Flores file this report from Mexico City.
The Coca-Cola company has no place at a place like the World Water Forum because it is relationship with water is extremely unsustainable. And the supposed goal and aim of the World Water Forum is to find sustainable uses of water.
Amit Srivastava is the director of the India Resource Center, an NGO critical of Coca-Cola's business practices in India.
What is the Coca-Cola company doing at the World Water Forum? It has no place here. It is doing one thing. It is using the World Water Forum, like other companies, to use it as a public relations exercise.
Coca-Cola has been the target of a growing international campaign calling for a boycott of its products. In India, the company has been accused of exploiting and polluting scarce freshwater resources.
Coca-Cola is leading the charge among corporations that are not only interested in bottling water and distributing it. It's a new phenomenon where corporations are actually going around the world to developing countries and buying up land in order to control water resources.
Joseph Kuhn is with War on Want, a British nonprofit that has just released a report documenting cases of Coke's strategic control of aquifers in a number of countries.
Aquifers are subterranean chambers that hold water that is filtered down over hundreds of years, and as such they represent a heritage of entire communities. And once Coca-Cola controls these aquifers, it bores deep into them and extracts the water in order to produce its beverages. And this has a devastating impact on local farmers.
Official data from the Ministry of Water Resources in India's desert state Rajasthan show that local water levels fell by nearly 10 meters in only 5 years after a Coca-Cola bottling plant began operations there. India Resource Center's Amit Srivastava says that 75% of the groundwater drawn by Coca-Cola in India is converted into wastewater.
Majority of the water is used to clean the bottles, clean the machines, clean this and that. They introduce chemicals into this water to clean. They make it wastewater. And then what has Coca-Cola done? Coca-Cola has let its wastewater flow directly outside its bottling plants all across India. What happens then? That water, polluted water, has leached through the soil into the scarce remaining groundwater. It has polluted the scarce remaining groundwater all across India. And very importantly, it has polluted the soil also.
Coca-Cola workers in Colombia blew the whistle on the practice of dumping untreated wastewater into local rivers.
Workers there also accused the company of using paramilitaries to intimidate and even kill unionized workers at their bottling plants. Luis Javier Correa is the president of Sinaltrenal, the National Union of Industrial Food Workers in Colombia. Correa says that 9 of Coca-Cola's unionized workers have been murdered since 1990.
Dos de ellos asesinados durante o en el momento en que nos encontrábamos negociando convenio colectivo.
Two of them were assassinated during negotiations of our collective contract, and one of them was assassinated while we were in the middle of a strike. They've imprisoned 14 of us. I've had to live with imprisonment on 2 occasions on charges brought by Coca-Cola officials. Also, 48 compañeros, including myself, have been victims of death threats. They've tried to kidnap our children, and they've tortured us. They've displaced compañeros. They have burned union halls.
Calls for a boycott of Coca-Cola began in reaction to allegations of violence against workers in Colombia, but has since grown to incorporate other demands for corporate responsibility. But the campaign against Coca-Cola has yet to become effective in Mexico, the number one per capita consumer of Coca-Cola products in the world. Gustavo Castro from the Center for Economic and Political Research in Chiapas laments that Coca-Cola is widely consumed, even in the state's Zapatista rebel communities.
Here in Mexico, the world's number one consumer of Coca-Cola, Chiapas is one of the 3 top states in Coca-Cola consumption. And unfortunately, along with Guerrero and Oaxaca, one of the states with the highest rates of malnutrition and poverty.
But campaigners are optimistic as the boycott receives increased international attention and gains student allies who have, in turn, influenced their universities to either suspend or cancel contracts with the soft drink giant. In Mexico City, I'm Shannon Young with Vladimir Flores for Free Speech Radio News.
Around Lake Victoria, the largest lake in Africa and the world's second largest freshwater lake, falling water levels are reducing the supply of water to millions. Environmentalists blame the falling water levels on human factors and poor policies by some East African governments. Joshua Chalimpa reports from Kampala.
East African environmentalists and others blame the region's falling water levels on the unchecked construction of dams at the mouth of Lake Victoria. Last month, Uganda was forced to reduce outflows at its Tiira and Narubale hydropower dams just north of the lake by about a third after environment watchdogs accused Uganda of draining the lake to maintain its electricity supply. Geoffrey Kamese of the Uganda-based National Association of Professional Environmentalists is also a representative of the Africa Rivers Network. Kamese says the power stations were responsible for half of the lake's depletion.
The 2 dams, that is Kira and Nalubale, have been draining water beyond the agreed curve. It is already scientifically proven. There are studies that indicate 55% of the water released from Lake Victoria is as a result of the 2 dams. And if only 45% of the water that is released is attributed to environmental factors, including the drought factor. So the 2 dams, which drain 55% of the water, are the main responsible factors for the decline levels in Lake Victoria.
Uganda is the custodian of a greater part of the lake, which is also the source of the River Nile, Africa's longest river. The body charged with the management of the lake insists that a long drought that has hit the region for the last 3 years is to blame for the falling water levels. The falling water levels has greatly affected the supply of water for domestic use. Msubuga Senfuma is Uganda's Commissioner for Water Resources Management.
Lake Victoria is a water body which is transboundary. It connects Uganda, Kenya, Tanzania, and to some extent Rwanda and Burundi, because rivers coming from Rwanda and Burundi drain in Lake Victoria. Now, we have had a long outstanding drought in the region for now about 3 years, meaning that the major rivers which input water in Lake Victoria, in particular those ones in Nzoia, Yala, Kagera and Mara Marakisi in Tanzania and Kenya have fallen in the volume, in the amount of water coming. As if that is not enough, the temperature on the water body, which has increased as a result of the heat, also has taken a lot of water from the system into the atmosphere. This is what we call evaporation. So 80% of the water coming on Lake Victoria is from rain. If the rain increases in the region, that's in Kenya, Tanzania, Rwanda, and Burundi, increasing more water in the rivers, eventually the lake will recover, but not immediately.
Environmentalists say the prolonged drought spells, notwithstanding construction of hydropower dams at the point where Lake Victoria pours into the River Nile, is largely to blame for the falling water levels from the lake. About 30 million people depend on the lake for their livelihood, but experts say the water levels is at an 80-year low, echoing recent UN charges that hydropower dams that have been constructed by Uganda are largely responsible for the falling water levels of Lake Victoria. Water is now being rationed to users because water pumps of the suppliers have been left hanging in the air as the water levels fall further. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Charimpo reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective produced at Pacifica stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFK in Los Angeles. You can check out our website at www.fsrn.org. In Berkeley, I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert, sitting in for Aldo Bogado.
This is Independent Native News for Tuesday, the 21st of March. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. Today marks the one-year anniversary of the tragic shooting on the Red Lake Band of Chippewa Indians Reservation in Minnesota, which left 9 people dead, including the shooter, 16-year-old Jeff Weiss. The Red Lake Tribal Council unanimously passed a resolution this week declaring March 21st a day of remembrance. The council recognizes the sadness and memories this day will hold for the families of the 9 victims, and the resolution specifically states that it will honor the privacy of each family and their tradition of mourning. To that end, there are no plans for a community observance, but resources that the band would have spent on a community feast will instead be distributed among the families for their own benefit. Meanwhile, Washington State and British Columbia are making amends for the lynching of an Aboriginal Canadian boy, which took place over 100 years ago. The event nearly started a cross-border race war at the time. Earlier this month, a ceremony recognizing the boy's innocence was held in Washington State. As correspondent Tom Bonzi reports, lawmakers hope to right the 122-year-old wrong.
Washington politicians, a B.C. provincial minister, and numerous tribal elders formed a healing circle, chanting and drumming together in the ornate Washington State Capitol Rotunda. The ceremony followed legislative passage of a resolution expressing the deepest sympathy to the descendants of 14-year-old Louis Sam. In 1884, a vigilante mob of Americans rode across the border near Sumas, Washington. They grabbed the native teenager from Canadian custody and hanged him from a tree. Louis Sam had been accused, wrongly it turns out, of the murder of a shopkeeper on the U.S. side of the frontier.
One of the things I've learned as I've grown older is the importance of being able to let the words, "I'm sorry," roll off your tongue when you are.
State Senator Cheryl Flug became emotional as she took the Senate floor to declare regret and sorrow for what happened long ago. A grand chief of the Stalo Tribal Council listened from a seat of honor in the state Senate. Fellow tribal leaders from the Canadian border region, including a family descendant of Louis Sam, looked on from the Senate gallery. Grand Chief Clarence Penier wore a cedar bark headpiece and a distinctive woolen cloak. He thanked the body, first in his native tongue.
It
makes us feel good, he continued in English. In an interview later, the Grand Chief said some Fraser Valley natives never fully let go of the injustice, despite the passage of time. By recognizing that a wrong was done, he said politicians are making it right.
It closes the door and it opens others by making sure that, you know, we can try to establish some relationships with each other.
An historian from the University of Saskatchewan brought the gruesome lynching back to light. Professor Keith Carlson was commissioned to unearth the true story while he worked as a consultant for the Stalo a few years ago. Carlson recalls the tribal passions ignited on this day in 1884.
The majority of the people wanted to charge across the border and kill the first 120 Americans they found as
to balance off the people who had been involved in the lynch mob. Some of the older men thought it was appropriate to cross the border, find one American, bring him back to the same tree, and lynch him on that tree.
Carlson said when the Canadian government got wind of the reprisal plans, it assured the tribal leaders that it would seek justice if they held back. The professor unearthed the notes of two provincial detectives who went undercover in Nooksack, Washington, to investigate.
They gathered all this evidence that clearly showed that Louis Sam was innocent of the original crime, and the names of the men, the Americans who killed the shopkeeper, and then to cover up their crime, organized the lynch mob to cover their tracks.
No one was ever prosecuted for either the murder or the lynching. Technically, the resolution passed Wednesday is not a formal apology, but the effect is the same. That was evident as Washington's Lieutenant Governor Brad Owen handed over the parchment to the visiting Native chief.
It is meant to further ensure that such a tragedy will never be forgotten nor repeated. Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Bonsi in Olympia.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by News from Indian Country's e-edition, online at IndianCountryNews.com. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.